Bonsoir, good evening, and welcome to you all. I'm very pleased to see you all here in great numbers. My name is Subhashish Ghoshal. I'm a professor in McGill Engineering and director of the Trottier Institute for Sustainability in Engineering and Design. And just a quick word about TISED, or the Trottier Institute. At TISED, we're actively engaged in research, teaching, and policy discussions on sustainability issues on a range of areas such as urban development and transportation, renewable energy, manufacturing, aviation, and IT. And so this is a fairly new institute and is becoming really a vibrant center of activity at McGill's Faculty of Engineering and in McGill as a whole. So the event of tonight, Storage and Sustainable Electric Systems, Technology Push and Policy Pull, is actually part of a new TISED program called the Research Workshop Program. And so this program has been created to promote forums for discussing advances in technology and policy, so technology design policy frameworks really on sustainable issues, and to identify decisions that are required to really advance sustainability. And so with this program, funding is actually awarded on a competitive basis to professors to propose an engaging program involving a public seminar such as this one that we have on for tonight, combined with a two-day workshop involving the speakers and a number of participants from industry, academia, and government to address critical issues at the interface of technology and sustainability policy. So I'd like to congratulate Professor François Bouffard for putting together a compelling proposal for this program. And so this program was selected among several others towards the first edition of the TISED Research Workshop Program. I'm also very pleased that Gerard, a multi-university research center on decision sciences, is collaborating with TISED on this workshop program. And it's my pleasure to invite Professor Jean-Philippe Waube, professor in geography at UCAM and director of Gerard, to say a few words.
Alors, bonsoir à tous et à toutes. Welcome, everybody. So it's my pleasure today to say a few words about Gerard. Gerard is a multidisciplinary, multi-university research center dedicated to the mathematics of decision making. It exists since 1979 and is a FRQNT strategic cluster. So its mission is to develop all aspects of the mathematics of decision-making in large complex systems and to continually push the limit of the size of the systems that we're able to analyze and optimize, and to diversify their nature in accordance with emerging needs like electric transportation, storage, and such issues. Also, it's to contribute to the building of collective wealth by transmitting knowledge and its application through academic and mass market publication, industry consultation, and the creation of spin-off companies. We have a few ones from Gerard. Our research program is divided in three main axes: the foundation of the mathematics of decision-making, with a number of teams, nine, large-scale system application in seven different domains, including energy and supply chain and things like telecom, and software for decision support. Gerard in numbers, we have about 69 members from 25 university departments, 18 associate members, more than 400 graduate and postgrad students, 12 research chairs, among them one in energy, of course, and four partner institutions, HEC, Polytechnique, McGill, and UCAM, and seven collaborating institutions through all the province. and it's a large network of public and private research partners and research users. Et nous sommes particulièrement fiers d'avoir le professeur François Bouffard aujourd'hui, qui est impliqué directement dans la chaire TICED et qui est un des fondateurs de cette réunion, enfin l'initiateur de cette réunion aujourd'hui dans l'organisation. Et d'autant plus qu'on a un autre chercheur dans l'autre chaire Trottier, qui est à Polytechnique Montréal et qui est aussi un membre du GERAD. Donc François, je te laisse introduire le panel.
Merci beaucoup.
So good evening. Bonsoir. Merci d'être ici. Thank you very much. So what's the point of storage? Really, that's the question you can ask yourself. Well, energy storage in electricity systems is anywhere, and actually within industry, it's everywhere. Any industry needs storage, be it from, you know, rocks in a quarry to bits on hard drives. But in the electricity system, traditionally, storage is not really sort of not common. Again, the storage that we have is basically the heap of coal that you have in the yard of the power station, or the gas in the pipeline feeding the power plants. And or, perhaps closer to our heart in Quebec, the water behind the dam. But the problem that we might say we have is that once the electricity is gone from the power station, we can't really get it back. You know, once you let the horse go off from the barn, it's gone. So to get it back requires some work and some effort. So, but when we look at now the transition towards decarbonized power systems, the role of storage is becoming essential, okay? We all know the cliche here that the sun doesn't shine all the time, doesn't shine at night especially, or not much during the winter, and the wind does whatever pretty much it wants. So the idea here is storage is essential in keeping the lights on and making sure that we, in the process, decarbonize the power industry. Because this is really what we're trying to do here. And the true value of storage really comes, for instance, if you look at the figure on the right, in furthering CO2 reductions that can come from storage itself. So for instance, if you look here, this is for Great Britain, where they made an assumption of 40 gigawatts of wind. So Great Britain, if you look at it from a comparison to the Quebec system, we are basically half of the British system. And if you insert here 40 gigawatts of wind, by putting in some extra storage, you can get extra CO2 reductions, because basically you can turn off the plants that are there to regulate, to offset the variability of wind, which is quite good. So if we look at the ecosystem in terms of technology for storage, this is quite diverse. We have, again, a very wide array of technologies when we're basically looking at what are the dimensions here. We're looking at how big is the storage operation, how much power, and then how much energy can it store. And traditionally in power systems since the last century, pump storage hydro has been basically the killer app. But nowadays we are seeing more different options being offered to us. So obviously the main mission for storage is to basically, you know, take in the energy when it's there, and especially in decarbonized power systems, take the energy when it's there and give it back when it's needed. But I'm a power engineer, and typically I only think about my own power systems problem. But it has to be a bit more holistic here. The environmental impact of some of these technologies, especially in terms of electrochemistry, can be quite important. So technology life cycle, what are we doing with the batteries once their lifetime is over? Then, so disposal, environmental risks, what if we have a leak in one of these things, in terms of land use and social acceptance. Again, land use, especially with respect to pump storage, you need to have two lakes at different altitudes to get that to happen. If you don't have it, then you can't do it. Also, from the point of view of natural resource impact, what if, again, in the next couple of years, we develop some technologies that require very rare materials that perhaps we need to mine in some country in Africa, which may also have pressures on commodity markets and geopolitics. Business impact, this is a new business. People are still grappling around how we're going to be doing this in the next couple of years, and also what should be prioritized in terms of R&D. And then finally, where this is the big challenge, this is again somewhat the focus of this workshop, is what should be the policy and the regulatory impact. Electric utilities are regulated. Their rate of return is regulated, and therefore that has an impact on how they're going to do business. And also the other thing that I've not mentioned before is that utilities are extremely conservative. They don't like to take in technologies that disturb how things are going. And then it comes to mention that, you know, how can you incentivize or bring in more storage in those systems? So incentives versus quotas, for instance. So if we look at what's been going on, and here I'm only giving you two examples. So there's been a growing interest in storage. So this is, again, a press release from Hydro-Québec about from last June, as Hydro-Québec has decided to embark on a joint venture with Sony from Japan. And last but not least, this is the key one, is the California storage mandate, which will be addressed by one of our speakers. It's a huge sort of game changer in the way we see storage in the industry right now. So again, the California legislature about a year ago voted that the utilities in California should be installing at least 1,300 megawatts of wind by 2020. This is quite a game changer. So this brings me to introduce to you our speakers. So we have Daniel Kirshen from the University of Washington, Geza Yosh from McGill, Jeff Gostick from Chemical Engineering here at McGill, Michel Bernier from École Polytechnique, Joe Eto from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, and Christopher Reagan from Department of Economics at McGill. It's interesting also to mention that today, you know, we are coupling California and Quebec. So we have our speaker, Joseph Eto, from California and Quebec. And today was the first day of the cap and trade auction for the Western Climate Initiative. So again, it's perhaps nice to mention that today. So California and Quebec are both together in the same boat to getting less carbon into this world. So thank you very much. So we'll bring in Daniel Kirshen, will be our first speaker.
Thank you very much, François, for inviting me to give this presentation. Bonsoir, c'est un grand plaisir pour moi d'être ici pour vous parler un peu de storage. François had an interesting slide where he was showing some work done in the UK about estimating the value of storage. And really my talk is a bit about a similar topic, trying to have a slightly more detailed look of what that means. But before I can go into that, I need to reinforce another point, which is about how a power system is run. Now, we actually call it a power system, the system that delivers electricity to you, rather than an energy system, because it's really based on the idea that the power produced has to be equal at all time to the power consumed, and the power being the rate of at which we deliver energy. So it's delivering to you power, meaning you can flip the switch anytime you want and you will get electricity. It's not just delivering you energy. Now, that works fine, but occasionally you have imbalances, and those imbalances happen on various timescales that go from seconds to days. For example, you can have outages. One of the power plants can suddenly go offline, and suddenly the power that it was producing is gone, and you have an imbalance. We have random fluctuations in the load. Every time I flip on the switch to turn on the lights or turn off the light, I'm changing the demand. That has to be handled. We have ramp rates. We have ramps. If all of us start getting up in the morning, that's going to create an increase in the power demand that needs to be dealt with. We have diurnal cycles, peak demand during the middle of the day, going down at night. We have weekly cycles, less demand during the weekend than during the work week. And then we also have unavailability when some power plants are not working because they don't have fuels, or periods of scarcity. Now, the traditional way to deal with imbalances was that the generation was going to follow the load, meaning that we needed flexible generation that could increase or decrease their output rapidly so that it could follow those imbalances and deal with these imbalances. Or these power plants had to be able to start quickly. And in some cases, we cycle them on and off on a daily basis. We also needed some reserve capacity to deal with unpredictable things like outages or changes in demand that we had not anticipated. And renewables makes things worse because they introduce more random fluctuations. As François said, the wind tends to change, the sun tends to change. They introduce ramps. If suddenly we have a front going through a region where we have lots of wind power plants, that can increase or suddenly decrease the amount of power produced. We have diurnal cycles, not just in solar production, but also in wind productions. In some part of the world, the wind blows more at night. And then we have periods of scarcity. So let me give you a few examples. We know quite precisely when the sun comes up and when it goes down. You know, astronomers have been working on that for a few millennia, so that is not an issue. But what we have not really been able to figure out quite well is about clouds. So, for example, we can tell that we're going to get solar production around this time in the morning, and it's going to drop at this point. But exactly when we get those big dips in production, when a cloud goes through, is not easy. And then there's the wonderful thing called the California duck curve, which is getting people rather concerned in California. So in this graph, I have time of day along the horizontal axis and the net load along the vertical axis. Now, the net load is the difference between the actual load, what you and I consume, and what gets produced by renewable energy sources that we don't control, particularly in this case, solar. And typically, the net load would go down to a minimum in the early hours of the morning and then go back up as like this during the middle of the day when we're all at work and industry is functioning, dip a little bit late afternoon and then go back up when people go home at night. California and Southern California, turn on the air conditioning, start cooking meal, watch television, and then go back down at night when people go to bed. Now, in Southern California, they have so much solar being installed that they're getting very concerned that instead of going up during the middle of the day, it would go down during the middle of the day when the sun is shining. And around 6 o'clock in the evening, two things happen. The sun is going down and people are going home. And then you get this enormous ramp, enormous increase in the demand for electricity that is going to have to come from somewhere. Here's another example from the part of the world where I come from. This is the demand in red over a week in what's called the BPA area. And you can see there are diurnal cycles here, go up two peaks per day and so on. And then here you have at the bottom, you have the wind production, which tends to have one cycle a day, peaking in at night. So that was a week in February of this year, and this is this week. Now, if you look carefully, you can see the green curve with the wind is at the bottom there. It's almost zero. We have a high-pressure zone. It's bright and cold in the Pacific Northwest. Doesn't happen to us very often in November, but there's no wind at all. So production is very, very small. So, as I said, renewable things makes things worse. And the other thing that's happening is renewables is replacing traditional generation in many parts of the world. If you had a coal plant and now there's a lot of wind generation, well, the wind generation is becoming cheaper, the coal plant is becoming uneconomical and is being shut down, replaced, disappearing. So you can't count on it for providing the flexibility you need to deal with these imbalances. Which brings me to storage. You know, storage is really the ultimate source of flexibility because it can provide you reserve capacity. You can suddenly increase the output of your storage devices and inject all those megawatts in the grid. You can use it for frequency control, for dealing with all those little changes in the load. Storage is great for that. You can use it for dealing with those big ramps like they're worried about in California. You can do temporal arbitrage. You know, you charge the storage when there's plenty of wind or plenty of sun, and you discharge when the sun goes down and the wind goes down. And you can also do spatial arbitrage, where if you have storage at different locations in the grid, you can use it to improve the transmission capacity of your network, avoid overloading the transmission lines in a grid. But there's a, the question is it going to be economically sustainable? Because on the one hand, we have all those good things that the storage can do, frequency control, reserve, ramping, arbitrage, and all of that. On the other hand, we have the fact that storage has a very large investment cost. Storage is not 100% efficient. These days, you only get about 80% of the energy back that you put in your batteries. And over time, the batteries tend to degrade. Every time you charge and discharge them, well, next time you try to charge them, you can charge them a bit less. So you have a question of how do I balance life cycle cost against those value streams? Can I demonstrate that the value I'm going to get from these batteries is bigger than their life cycle cost? So how should we proceed? Well, I think we need to spend a fair amount of time and energy in quantifying those value streams. And it's pretty clear that some are going to be easier than others to quantify. Arbitrage, straight arbitrage, is pretty straightforward. You buy low, you sell high. You know, anybody who does a bit of finance knows that. Others, like value for frequency control, for reserve, for helping with transmission networks, are a lot harder to estimate. Then we need to investigate compatibility, because we might be able to use these batteries for doing different things at the same time, doing frequency control at the same time as you do arbitrage and you do reserve. But the question is, can we use the same megawatts or megawatt hours for two or more purposes at the same time, or is that just not possible? And then there's something I like to call chemical compatibility. As I mentioned, batteries degrade when you charge and discharge them. But this degradation depends on the type of application. Is it a deep discharge? Is it a shallow discharge? That affects how long the battery is going to live. And also, the different types of batteries have different degradation characteristics. So should we have different batteries for different applications? Or can we combine these different applications in the same batteries? So this is some of the plans that I think we should pursue, and I look forward to the question and answer section. Merci beaucoup.
Bon, mesdames et messieurs, bonsoir. Mon nom est Gézaïo, je suis de département de génie électrique ici à l'Université McGill. Puis je tiens à remercier François Bouffard de m'avoir invité. So my talk will deal with electricity storage as an enabler for the integration of distributed generation based on renewable energy. As Dr. Kirshen pointed out, one of the roles of storage is to balance renewable energy. I'm going to look at the issue from the distribution network point of view. In other words, from the network that feeds residential, commercial, and industrial loads at typically 25 kV and below in Quebec. So here are some of the new developments, the opportunities for storage. As I indicated, renewable energy integration, GHG reduction, greenhouse gas reduction, is one of the applications. The most important renewable energy sources in the world today are solar, and in Quebec it's mostly wind. Advantages are that it's available locally, there's no fuel, no transportation cost, it's an opportunity to develop remote areas, to create employment, etc. Storage is seen as a means of balancing, averaging renewables, variable, dealing with variable and intermittent energy resources. It's seen as a way of load leveling, So those are two of the issues that are tied together. I'm going to argue here that one of the better ways of integrating storage in distribution systems is by using the concept of microgrids. Microgrids as, and I'll define it in a minute, microgrids as a distribution system modernization approach, because we have to modernize our grid. One of the grids that has not been touched recently is a distribution grid. There's a lot of work that has been done on the transportation grid. It's as intelligent as need be. The distribution grid is a totally different story. At the moment, it's fed from substations. There's no generation locally. It's mostly loads. And situation is changing now because we're adding renewables locally and we're adding storage. Other issues include the electrification of road transportation, notably electric and hybrid vehicles. And people are talking a lot about these as loads and generators, the famous vehicle-to-grid approach. Then there's the whole issue of remote and isolated grids, where there is an opportunity to integrate renewables. And there's a lot of talk, in at least in the U.S., about net-zero green communities. These are essentially communities where you do not have to supply net energy over a certain period of time, let's say a year. So this is a picture. It's taken from the internet. Most of my pictures are taken from the internet. I don't acknowledge authors because I don't know them, but I apologize for having plagiarized. So fundamentally, a microgrid is defined as a system, a distribution system, that is grid-tied, so it's fed from a substation, but it has features that allow it to produce its own generation, some of it, maybe not 100%, mostly from renewables, wind. There's not that much hydro except in remote communities. Solar is a big source of energy. Then you have waste is another source, biofuels. In most cases, particularly in remote communities and in a lot of other applications, you do want to count on something that's always there, that's dispatchable. You use a diesel generator or some other kind of generation, like combined heat and power or gas turbines. And then the new stuff that comes into it, which is storage. Storage in the form of capacitors, storage in the forms of electric vehicles. As I mentioned before, electric vehicles have batteries, so they can be seen as loads when you charge them, but they can also be used as a battery source when they're fully charged and connected to your home. And then you have battery storage systems, and as was mentioned, Hydro-Québec is developing battery storage systems for the distribution grid. And they're trying to make a business case out of it, so this is one of the applications. Now, you can extend the whole concept of microgrids to other types of grids. So at the lowest level, you look at a nanogrid. The nanogrid is just a home. The storage can be a storage element to handle solar energy, the variability of solar energy, but you can also look upon it as being your electric vehicle that's in the garage. And then if you go a bit bigger, you look at the microgrid, and it also has storage in a number of places, in particular to handle PV variability. And then you can combine nanogrids, microgrids into mini-grids, and mini-grids are then tied to the main grid, the transmission grid. So that's a picture of what people see as coming. The only thing is that to be able to handle all of this, you need a lot of electronics and a lot of control. Another very promising application, particularly in Canada and in remote places, is the remote community grids. I put this picture there to show that storage is not only battery storage. Some people are pushing hydrogen storage, fuel cells. It's an option. The only problem is that we still have to see a commercially viable fuel cell. But this is an example of what was tried in Newfoundland. They had a diesel generator, they had a wind turbine, they added another wind turbine to have more renewable. The only problem is that you can end up with excess wind energy when the wind blows or at night or in places like that. So essentially you convert that into hydrogen, you store it in a tank, and then you either burn it in a diesel generator, which is feasible, or a fuel cell, and you produce energy on demand. So this system becomes essentially dispatchable energy. So those are the applications of microgrids. Now, what are the business cases? Because behind all of this, there's a question of money. There's a question of investment. You're not going to pay something very expensive if you have the grid, you're grid tied, and the grid provides you electricity at 5 or 7 cents a kilowatt hour, and here essentially you're producing at 40, 50 cents. There's no business case there. The question is then, where's the business case? Well, there's definitely a business case in remote communities in Quebec and in Canada, and it's essentially displacing or replacing diesel based electricity generation, which is very expensive. Typically, you're looking at 40, 50 cents a kilowatt hour, so there's a business case there. Assuming that remote communities can operate the complexity of a microgrid. And then there's other installations, and there's a lot of them in the U.S. that require high reliability and resiliency. Resiliency is a very big issue since Sandy destroyed a lot of the New York and New York area electric power grids, and there was a blackout that lasted a long time. So resiliency is a big issue. So you have military bases that could benefit, government compounds, sensitive manufacturing installation, data centers, all systems that require premium power. Other development, potential developments, and the current demonstration projects in many of these areas, net zero communities, energy independence, fast EV charging stations along highways would require storage if you wanted to make them efficient, electrified transportation, and self-contained entities, like we're talking a lot in the States about university campuses that are microgrids, government labs, and so on. So, of course, technology is evolving, and there's certain things that you want to happen to make them cost-effective. Everything has to do with reducing the cost. So what are the elements that can reduce the cost of an installation? First of all, there's a battery cost, and there's a lot of effort going into that. And then there's a whole issue of development and standardization of energy management systems. One of the arguments for putting together microgrids is that storage is embedded, but the requirement then is that you need an energy management system to manage all the generation, the storage, and the loads. Then you have to develop, and there's a lot of work going on in that area, to affordable and suitable sensors, information and communication technologies. And then there's the whole issue of standardization of microgrid controllers and energy management systems. Other requirements include the evolution of the regulatory context, and people mentioned that you have to redefine the role and relationship of the microgrid to the distribution system, in other words, the relationship between the distribution system operator and the local autonomous microgrids. And you also have to allow the microgrid to enter the energy market to play with the distribution system so that you essentially can sell services, either sell energy or sell services. And that's my presentation. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good evening. My name is Jeff Gostick. I'm from the Department of Chemical Engineering at McGill, and I'm going to talk about electrochemical energy storage, which has been alluded to a few times already. So I'll start by giving a real-world example of some large-scale energy storage that's being done electrochemically, and that is so-called green gas in Germany. So I was recently in Germany, and I was struck by the number of windmills that you can see when you're traveling around. So this is an image where you can see some windmills in the foreground, and perhaps you can see another row of windmills in the background, then another row of windmills beyond that, and pretty much as far as the eye can see. So there's a lot of wind power being generated. I think it's something like 40% at certain times. So there's a surplus power, of course, because we know the wind's blowing when we don't need it and so on. So the excess power is being given away to neighboring countries for free. So the solution is let's store this energy and use it. So I've color-coded that solution as green because that's a good idea. Second problem arises is that, okay, now how are we going to store this energy? How are we going to actually implement this idea? So geological energy storage, such as massive hydroelectric dams, are not available in Germany. So that's unfortunate. So, but there's no other readily available or commercially viable storage technologies other than water splitting to make hydrogen. So electrolysis is an old technology, and it's commercially viable and so on. So they're splitting water to make hydrogen. So I've colored that orange because that's a little suboptimal. It has a high energy, low energy efficiency. So that's orange in its quality of solution. And finally, where do you put this hydrogen? There's no hydrogen infrastructure. Hydrogen storage tanks are expensive. So where is this hydrogen going to go? Well, the answer is to let's inject it into our natural gas pipelines that we have crisscrossing our country. And that is a red solution because it's a waste of hydrogen. It's like pouring champagne into a hydroelectric dam to raise its level. You know, it's not a good use of hydrogen. You can do much more efficient things with it. But it works. So natural gas end users can tolerate 5% hydrogen in their fuel without noticing any difference in performance or properties or so on. So it's working. They're doing that. But obviously there is a need to do something a little bit better. So we'll probably see this slide 6 times, one for each speaker. But here is the problem. When you have your house connected directly to a windmill, the windmill stops blowing, stops producing power, but your house doesn't stop demanding power. So on the top left is the blue is the power output from the windmill, and on the right is the electricity demand on the house. So this is not going to match when you overlay these two things. You're going to have blackouts and so on. So the solution is to fill a battery-shaped black box somewhere between the windmill and the house. And this will allow the wind power profile and the house demand profile to be able to match by charging the battery as needed when the wind is blowing, draining the battery when the house needs to, a little extra power, and so on, so that the output of the windmill appears to match the demand of the house. So that's the plan. Put some intermediate buffer between these two beginning and end of this power system. I've created a set of rules for joules for this talk. I started thinking, brainstorming, what are the important things to think about for energy storage? And I have 6 of them, and 7 and higher will maybe be discussed tomorrow. It was mentioned in the introduction that there's a workshop tomorrow, and we'll all put our minds together, perhaps expand this list. But I will go over these 6. I'm not going to go over them right now because we're going to talk about them one at a time. So firstly, location, location, location. So the poster child for energy storage is hydroelectric reservoirs. And, of course, it's quite simple. When you have excess energy, you just run some pumps to put water uphill. And when you need it, you let the water go downhill and operate your dam as normal. So this is great. There's no nasty chemicals. Pumps can be run very efficiently. Everything works just great. The dams are already in place. The trouble is it's not possible in most places. So that violates, the location. There's another aspect of location as well, and that is that if you compare where the wind, in this instance I'm showing the wind generation in America versus the population density in the bottom right, the wind is not being generated anywhere near where the people are, so you have to get the energy to them over long, long distances sometimes. So if the wind happens to be blowing very hard and the demand in New York City also happens to be very high, that's great, except you still can't pipe the energy to them directly because the transmission system might not be able to take it. So you still need, even though you have a magical match between the demand and the supply, you still can't use it necessarily. Also, you can't necessarily pump that energy to a hydroelectric reservoir that's far away because, again, the same problem. You can't surge a whole bunch of energy through these transmission lines. So the solution is to store your energy locally at the windmill. And electrochemical energy storage, as in the form of batteries and other things, is location neutral. So so when you have location issues, the electrochemical energy storage is your only option. Rule 2, this would probably be the main one, is to decouple storage and generation. So the question is, would you rather heat your house with a stove made of wood or a wood stove? So this is you know, meant to be a joke, of course. You would not heat your house with a wooden stove. You would be able to do that one time and the stove would be gone. However, on the right, you, of course, have a massive pile of wood that can be replenished and depleted at will, and the wood stove will survive, and you can constantly, you've decoupled your heat generation and your heat storage. So we do the same thing with batteries. You can have a flow of batteries. So if you take copper top batteries, they look something like this inside, and I'll talk about the internals a little bit in a moment. But if you want more energy storage, you need more batteries. And once the battery is depleted, the fuel is gone, and the casing that does the reaction is also gone, so you have to bring in more batteries. The alternative to having a flow of batteries is to have a flow battery. And this, if you could imagine your battery that was, say, the internal reactants were liquid, you could pump them through in a cycle. And if you want more storage, you just increase the size of your tanks. So this is the concept of a flow battery. Let's take the reacting chemicals out of the power generating device and store them externally. And then you've decoupled the storage and the generation. This is a familiar concept, of course, because it's the one we use, A, for our wood stove and also for our car. So the gas tank is the storage and the engine is the generation. So we've decoupled that successfully already. So it's not exactly rocket science to do this, but it's worth pointing out that this technology wasn't developed by NASA in the 70s. So it is actually rocket science. Third rule, the process must be reversible, highly reversible. So again, I'll compare the copper top battery. If you were to look inside one of these batteries with a microscope, you would see solid zinc particles, shiny zinc metal sitting in there in a porous electrode. And as the battery is depleted, the zinc dissolves into a liquid electrolyte and it's gone. It can't be returned. And the zinc particles themselves disappear like a sugar cube dissolving. You cannot recover this battery, because the zinc has nowhere to go when you want to recharge it. The rechargeable batteries that we do know are lithium-ion batteries work in a similar way. You have a solid electrode with little chunks of material in there, but instead of the material dissolving, lithium is embedded in the material. And as you run the battery, the lithium leaves the structure out into the electrolyte in exactly the same way, but the structure remains so that when you charge it, the lithium can go back into the structure. The template is there. So the shelf that you put the lithium there on, it remains. So it is highly reversible, and that's great, but of course lithium-ion batteries still suffer from the problem of not decoupling the storage and the generation. So, and the flow battery in this situation, the liquid contains the reactive species in a liquid form, which flows through the cell, comes up to a solid surface, grabs or releases an electron, and then just continues on its way through the cell and into the outlet tank. And when you want to recycle this thing, you just turn the pumps in the other direction, and you pump that spent fuel, which in this case is B, back through, and turn it back into A. So it's highly reversible. The solid phase, of the solid electrode is not involved at all, so there's very, you know, excellent degradation or very high degradation potentially. Degradation tolerance, pardon me. Now, rule four, size does not matter generally because we're talking about stationary applications. So just to divert for a second, when we talk about cars, size matters a lot. So we have this plot called a Ragone plot where you can plot different energy and power sources by their energy and power density. So on the vertical axis is the power, which is equivalent to the horsepower of your engine. And on the bottom axis is the energy, which is kind of equivalent to the range of your car. So you want to be at the top right of this thing, and that is where gasoline-powered cars live, because gas is very energy-intense, and internal combustion engines are very powerful. So when you're talking about replacing fossil fuels in cars, you have to look at this plot and say, well, you know, lithium-ion batteries aren't very good there. They're not even... This is a log scale, too, by the way. I mean, anyway, so it's even worse than it looks. So hydrogen fuel cells are there, technically speaking. And as was mentioned, commercially, they're not cheap enough yet. But that's why there's such an interest in hydrogen fuel cells, is because they're competitive on this chart to actually make transportation work. Now, getting to the point, size does not matter for stationary applications because... most of these things are going to be in remote locations, arid deserts for solar power or rough terrain for wind power or so on. So you can put a large installation of flow batteries in this field and nobody will really mind. So size doesn't matter, but cost does matter. So we can make the same sort of plot, but instead of comparing it as size density, let's compare it more of a size per cost So on the x-axis, let's talk about the power per dollar, and on the vertical axis, talk about power per dollar, and on the bottom axis, the energy per dollar. So this is the same two things now, but I'm just talking about cost instead of the weight. So putting gasoline on this chart would look something like this. So I guess the bottom axis would be kind of the cost of the chemicals, and the vertical axis would be the cost of the equipment used to do the conversion. So gasoline we'll put on here somewhere just as a reference. This is completely qualitative, by the way. And let's put pumped hydro up there since it's the poster child. So it would have very cheap chemicals, being water, which is essentially free. And even though a hydroelectric dam would be quite expensive to build, it's very powerful. So the ratio ends up being quite high. And also another thing to think about is that their durability is extremely high, so they last a century perhaps if maintained properly. So you get a lot of cycles out of that electric dam. So even though it's very expensive, it is good on the vertical axis. So now let's put the hydrogen splitting technology that they're using in Germany, the raw material being water, so it's equivalent to hydro in that respect, but it's much, much lower on this axis because the device requires platinum to work, and it is a very expensive device. Lithium-ion batteries are not going to be as cheap on the bottom axis as a high electrolyzer because you have expensive chemicals in there and metals and so on. It's not going to be as cheap as water. And it's also going to be more expensive on the y-axis than electrolyzers because you have to make many, many batteries when you want to increase your power. So it's very poor in that regard. And finally, flow batteries have the potential to move up and over on this axis with engineering and technological breakthroughs. There's nothing stopping it from approaching gasoline in terms of the cost. It'll never approach it, at least the technologies we have on the radar today will never approach it in terms of weight, but it could approach it in terms of cost. So it's potentially very cheap, and that's why a lot of people are talking about it for large-scale energy storage. And rule six, don't create new problems, but don't solve an old problem by creating a new one. And Francois mentioned that some of the environmental hazards of electrochemical energy storage. So I've drawn these two nice tanks filled with this arbitrary chemical, but these things could be potentially quite nasty. So when you're deciding which chemicals to put in these two tanks, the periodic table is at your disposal, more or less. So the iron chromium one at the top. So there's two chemicals involved. Some of them, one can be fine, and one of them can be nasty. And I've color coded them. So the iron chromium would not be good because chromium is bad. So you wouldn't want that tank to leak into your water table and pollute your water supply with chromium. The vanadium battery is very popular because it has vanadium on both sides, and it's convenient for academics to study. But I don't think it's a good idea. Vanadium is very toxic. Lead, as we all know, is toxic, so there's these lead batteries. I don't think we should be using lead. As you move down, hydrogen is a safe gas. It's explosive, but so is propane and gasoline, and we deal with those just fine. So the hydrogen bromine cell is an option, and the bromine on the one side. Bromine is not all that toxic, but it's not going to be a replacement for olive oil or anything like that. So, color-coded that orange. As we move down, there's been a recent development from them using a quinone, which is a fancy kind of hydrocarbon molecule that has no valuable chemicals at all. It just has standard hydrocarbon things in it. So the raw materials are extremely cheap. So it has the potential to do amazing things. And it is, let's call that green because it doesn't have any heavy metals in it. And the report that made this discovery used bromine as one side, but they hinted that they could potentially use quinones on both sides. So that has a tremendous potential. So things are definitely moving in the right direction in this regard. And I'll just say at the end, I've also put hydrogen and air. This is the fuel cell that people have been talking about for a couple of decades now that it's going to go in cars. And it's green for sure on both sides. It's very environmentally benign technology. So that's why it's so appealing. That concludes my talk, and I'd like to thank everybody involved.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Bonsoir tout le monde. J'aimerais d'abord remercier le professeur Bouffard pour l'invitation. C'est toujours un plaisir de, en tant que diplômé de l'Université McGill, de revenir au Bercail. My talk will be slightly different in that I'll be talking about thermal energy storage in buildings. And I will center my talk around three examples that we find in Quebec and in Canada. Basically, electric hot water tanks, high temperature compact storage, and I will also talk about the success story, the Drake Landing Solar Community. Let's start perhaps by talking about the energy situation in Quebec. Here you have the electric energy consumption by sector, that's the 2011 statistics. On the left, you have the three major sectors, commercial, residential, and industrial. You can see that the residential sector has an energy consumption of about 34%. And if you look at this piece of the pie on the right, you'll see that space heating is responsible for 21% and domestic hot water for 4%. So adding these two numbers together, we get 25%. So 25% of all the energy consumption in Quebec is dedicated to residential space heating and domestic hot water. So that's a lot of energy for these two purposes. Now, if we look at the relative grid power supply in a cold climate, such as in Quebec, with a high penetration of electric space heating, such as in Quebec. And if we look at what happens over the year, this is January 1st and this is December 31st, we get a grid that resembles this curve here. In the winter, we get 100% of grid supply, and in the middle of the summer, this goes down to 60% to 70%. Now, this curve is particular to the province of Quebec. If we go to the next province in Ontario, this curve is totally different. It's much flatter, and in fact, the peak is in the summer. So in Quebec, we have a particular situation where the peak is definitely in the winter because of the space heating. Now, if we focus on one particular winter day, the peak winter day, we get something similar to this. Here we have grid power in megawatts, and we have this grid power over a 24-hour period, again, in the peak winter day. Last year, we hit a peak of close to 39,000 megawatts. And at that peak, about 11,000 megawatts was for residential space heating, and another 2,000 megawatts was for domestic hot water heating. So a lot of power for these two purposes. The other thing about this curve is you may have noticed there are two peaks. There's one peak in the morning when people get up, and there's another peak in the evening when people have supper. It's not a duck curve. I guess we can call it a camel curve or whatever. But anyway, this is significant. Of course, the utility don't like these peaks, and it would be nice to reduce these peaks and use these valleys to use these valleys for a good use. Now, if we summarized all these graphs that I've shown so far, a quarter of the total annual electric energy consumption is dedicated to space heating and domestic hot water, and about a third of the power demand at peak conditions is for residential space heating and domestic hot water. So that offers, I think, a great potential for power and energy savings using thermal energy storage. And again, I'll show you three examples, starting with electric hot water tanks. A typical Quebec family will consume about one tank full, which is about 250 liters per day. This corresponds to about 15 kilowatt hours per day, and on an annual basis, about 5,000 kilowatt hours. This is incidentally a tank that I have in my lab. It's not a commercial tank. It's a laboratory tank that's transparent for flow visualization studies. But I wanted to show that an electric hot water tank has basically two heating elements, one on the top and one on the bottom. Now, if we look at what's the average power demand of an electric hot water heater, this curve is shown in blue actually here, and the scale is on the right. So the average power demand of an electric hot water heater is about 1 kilowatt, okay? And we have 2.5 million hot water tanks in Quebec, so 1 kilowatt times 2.5 million, that's a lot of kilowatts. And I've superimposed on this the red curve that I've shown earlier, the total grid power in peak day in Quebec. And as you can see, there's a correspondence in the peaks of the hot water tanks and the grid. And this offers a great possibility if we were to switch off some of the hot water tanks. It would enable us to reduce the grid peak. And in fact, I did a study a number of years ago, and I simulated what would happen if we were to shut off the bottom heating element of a quarter of a million hot water tanks in Quebec. And what would happen is that during the morning peak, we would have a reduced a grid power, shown on the bottom curve here, and we would displace the load to the valley that we have in the mid-afternoon. So from a grid, from a utility perspective, that's a good thing. And for the evening peak, we would be able to reduce this evening peak by about 500 megawatts just by shutting off the bottom heating element of electric hot water tank. So that's, I think, one way to alleviate these peaks that we have on the grid, just by shutting off the bottom heating element with a timer, very basic stuff. The second example I wanted to show is a device that's been developed by some researchers at Hydro-Québec's research lab in Shawinigan, which I think is a kind of a neat device. It's basically a baseboard heater, and if you look inside, you have ceramic bricks that are heated with electric heating elements, and these bricks are heated up to about 500 degrees C. So we have high temperature thermal storage. And these bricks are heated overnight when we have a valley on the grid power. And when we need some heating during the day, we don't feed these electric heating elements. We just let this energy that's been stored used in the house or in the building. And it works great. Here you have some results in that were measured data at a building, a commercial building in Quebec City, the E.H. Price building. In this building, what they did, they installed about 60 of these radiators. And here we see the power curve over a 24-hour period. And you can see that overnight from midnight to about 8 in the morning, these units would be on, and they would draw about 100 kilowatts, and they would be most of them would be shut off in the morning, and they would not require much power during the daytime when the grid has these two peaks that I mentioned earlier. And in the evening at around 10 o'clock, then these units would be re-energized for the next day. On the top curve, you see the temperature inside these radiators. You can see that when we're charging them in the middle of the night, we're reaching about 500 degrees C. And as we discharge them, the temperature decreases to about 300 degrees C. We still have some energy at the end of this particular day. The third example I wanted to show is has to do with seasonal thermal energy storage. The first two examples were daily thermal energy storage. This is a curve that we often see. This is a full year. The red curve shows solar availability. We have more solar in the summer, as we all know. And the blue curve is the space-eating needs in a northern climate such as our climate. So you can see that, as I mentioned in the bottom here, the space-eating needs and solar availability are not in sync. It would be nice if we could store the solar energy that we have in the summer and use it in the winter, do what we call seasonal thermal energy storage. And the best example of this is actually in Canada. It's called the Drake Landing Solar Community. It's located near Calgary. And what you see on this picture taken in the winter, you see that it's been snowing. And the dark alleys are actually thermal solar collectors on garages, on the garage of each house. And we're collecting solar heat in this particular case in the winter, but we're also collecting solar heat in the summer. And we're actually using a system that's depicted here. This is a very basic schematic. It's a bit more complicated than that, but for this talk, I think it's adequate. What we're doing, basically, we have a solar collector. We're collecting solar energy in the summer, and we're storing it in the ground, actually, in what we call a borehole thermal energy storage. So we basically heat the ground to about 60, 70 degrees C. I'll show you some curves in a minute. And we use this stored energy to heat the houses in the winter. So we have a circuit where we feed the houses with hot water coming from the ground. And when we don't have enough heat from the ground, we just use auxiliary heating. This has been working fine for the last 5 years. Here we have measured temperature in the borehole storage over, again, a five-year period. So we've reached sort of a steady state. And as you can see, as indicated here, in the beginning of the summer, we charged the ground. We charged the ground. So I'll come back. There we go. Sorry about that. So we charged the ground up to about 60 degrees C, and when the winter starts, we pump this hot water, or in this particular case, it's hot water, to fill the space heating needs of the various houses. And we do this every year, and we can see the five cycles here, and it's been working fine. And the results, and this is my last slide, this shows the blue curve that I've shown earlier, the space heating needs. And with this facility, we were able to fill these needs with 95% solar. We only need about 5% of auxiliary heat. So we have what we call a solar fraction of 95% for space heating. So 95% of the space heating comes from renewable energy. So it's quite an accomplishment, and it's been working fine for the last 5 years. And I guess most of you haven't heard about it. So to summarize my talk, I think I've shown that buildings use a substantial amount of energy. Buildings in Quebec require a significant amount of power at peak conditions. There are solutions to reduce the energy and power impacts of building, and I've shown three examples, electric hot water tanks, compact high temperature storage, and the last one, seasonable storage in boreholes. On that, I'll be happy to answer any questions during the Q&A session. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here. As the only person not from an academic institution, I think I need to introduce myself first. I work at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. This is a Department of Energy laboratory that is managed by the University of California at Berkeley. And so while my pen is owned by the Department of Energy, I am actually an employee of the University of California. And I'd also like to start by one of the most important messages that I have for you tonight about Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Our acronym is LBNL, and what that stands for is Lawrence Berkeley, not Livermore. Livermore National Laboratory is where the U.S.'s nuclear arsenal is designed and where they're trying to recreate the fusion that takes place on the sun. My laboratory is about 50 miles away, and we do no classified research. Instead of making bombs, we make Nobel Prizes. On the slide that Jeff showed earlier, showing the periodic chart, if you look very closely, the things that you didn't have to actually learn in chemistry include elements like berkelium, californium, americium, lawrencium, seaborgium. These were all discovered at my laboratory. So it's a non-classified facility, a multi-purpose science laboratory, and in my area, doing work on electricity policy. So what I've been asked to do tonight is talk about a really quite remarkable public policy development in California, in which the state legislature, as a result of action by our state legislature, our Public Utilities Commission has directed our investor-owned utilities to procure 1.3 gigawatts of electricity storage over the next 5 years. To give you a sense of the magnitude of that amount of electricity storage, the peak demand for my state is approximately 60 megawatts. So this is like about 2-3% of the installed capacity of the state. To put it into another perspective, in the United States altogether, there's about 23 gigawatts of pump storage, and about 1 gigawatt of all other forms of storage. So when California is done, they will have doubled the installed capacity of non-pumped hydro electricity storage in various forms within our state. What I'm going to talk about is sort of what was the motivation for California to take this aggressive technology-forcing action. And I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the public process that our Public Utilities Commission underwent to determine what those targets would be and how they would be implemented. And I'll close with the sort of a summary of what it is we're actually going to do, and then I'll look forward to your questions at the very end. So the actions that were taken in California really are the culmination or the latest installment of a long series of public policies in California aimed toward reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases. So I would say the keystone for this policy was a law passed in my state in 2006 that would reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2020. That's about a 15% reduction from where they were at in 2006 when the law was passed. That's led us to also pass a law called the Renewables Portfolio Standard, mandating that we will get 33% of our electricity from renewable energy sources by the year 2020. It's been supplemented by a very generous incentive program that pays down the cost of solar generation facilities, both residential PV as well as central solar stations. We have a federal production tax credit that provides a great subsidy to the wind industry. So a lot of very aggressive greenhouse gas reducing policies, as well as renewable energy forcing policies. I didn't also mention that we also have a loading order in California, which says that utilities, in terms of looking to meet their resource needs going forward, will first look at energy efficiency, second, demand response, and third, renewable energy before looking to conventional sources for expanding the source of supply. So you have a series of different public policies all forcing these issues forward, and it's in this context that our legislature adopted a target and directed our Public Utilities Commission to determine, and I want to talk about this determination process very much in my presentation, determine whether it would be appropriate to have a procurement target for energy storage. So this doesn't occur in a vacuum, but rather in the context of a variety of other public policies that are going on. So let's talk about the California Public Utilities Commission. In my country, we have several kinds of utility forms of organization. And in California, the dominant form of organization is where the utilities are owned by private investors. These are called investor-owned utilities. And in return for the monopoly franchise that they're granted over a geographic service territory, they submit to a public process, an administrative law process, that is managed by the California Public Utilities Commission, in which their rates are adjudicated in a public process in which testimony is heard about what the rate should be, intervening parties debate, judges make a ruling, and then a panel of five commissioners ultimately make the decision. So that applies to the three major this law applies to the three major utilities in my state. That's the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, shown in blue, the Southern California Edison Company, shown in pink, and the San Diego Gas and Electric Company, shown in green at the bottom. Those three companies together account for about 70% of the electricity use in the state of California. So again, this law really is speaking only to that process. So this is really going to be a talk more about regulatory policy and economics. And as a consequence, this is the last picture that I'll actually show. In fact, I have a slide with text on it that you can't even read. So you're going to see some words in the next few slides here. But what I really want to focus on is the process by which we came to this decision about adopting this target for the energy storage. So the PUC went through a very deliberative process to determine whether there was a justification for having a procurement target. And they started by identifying what the applications of storage might be. This is all done through a public hearing process where people come and offer their perspectives. There's many workshops. Everything is on the web. In fact, for those of you who have an interest, you can go to this website, and all the documents that I'll be drawing on from this presentation are publicly posted, along with a number of other informational sources about energy storage and its applicability in California. And one that's of particular interest is where we do analysis of the cost effectiveness of energy storage. And those are analyses that might be of interest to you. So these are the applications. Bulk storage on the transmission system really looks at putting a storage to even out the loads, even out that duck curve that was shown earlier. Ancillary services, those were also mentioned by Professor Kirshen. Those refer to the frequency regulation and the ramping activities. On-site generation in this case, and on-site generation variable, involves co-locating the storage at a generation site. Obviously, the ones with the variable generation are the ones that are of more interest here. They also consider distribution applications, looking at relieving the peak demands on distribution feeders, also the idea of controlling them from utility substations, and also the idea of community energy storage, which was one of the concepts that was presented very recently here. In addition to these utility grid applications, they've also considered customer-sided applications. Bill management refers to a situation in California where we have a lot of customers who are on time-differentiated tariffs where the price of electricity is high during the middle of the day and it's low at night, and that presents an arbitrage opportunity for energy storage. Bill management with market participation refers to being able to sort of arbitrage against your electricity rates as well as participate potentially in the wholesale electricity market that's run by the California Independent System Operator. Behind the meter and load control, that refers to something very similar to what Professor Bernier was talking about, and where the utility might control the load on some of your appliances that have storage built into them, such as thermal storage, to provide system relief as well as trying to minimize the impact on the amenity that's provided by those end-use devices. Permanent load shedding is also sort of what Professor Bernier was talking about, thermal energy storage being the most prominent example. Sort of, again, taking advantage of the rate differential to load up a storage system when the price of electricity is low and discharge it when the price of electricity is high. And then, of course, there's electric vehicle charging. So for each of these use cases, then through a deliberative process to consider the following questions, which is energy storage are the technologies actually viable for providing these applications? if they are viable, if they're operationally feasible, what are the potential benefits? Do they have benefits? Now, are these benefits that someone can take to the bank, or are these benefits for which markets do not yet exist, or which are intangible, and so it's very difficult to assign a benefit to them? Given both the benefits that you could quantify, monetize, et cetera, as well as those that you can't, can you make a determination whether it's a good idea? Is it cost effective in the broader societal sense of the term to have storage in these applications? So again, this is a very deliberative process about, you know, why should we have a public policy to promote this? And specifically, if it is cost effective, but it's not being taken up by the marketplace, what's holding things up? What are the barriers in our regulations, in our laws, in the way the markets are operating that prevent the storage that is cost effective and ought to be beneficial to society from being realized? And it's in that context that the Public Utilities Commission considers this question of, should we therefore have a target to try to stimulate the adoption of this technology? So it's really not sort of they didn't just start out like, okay, the legislature said, you know, you should procure all this storage, so let's just go figure out what the rules are for procurement. Instead, they wanted to go through a very deliberative process of what should be procured, why should it be procured, and use that to inform the decision about how it should be procured. So here's a slide that I don't expect you to read. But what this slide does is down here, they identified a number of barriers, and I want to spend some time talking about them. But then they also looked across both the different regulatory proceedings that they had underway, as well as proceedings that go on by organizations outside their jurisdiction. The FERC is our federal energy regulator. The California ISO, you've heard about. And the California Energy Commission is yet another regulatory entity in California that's responsible for, say, building energy efficiency standards, among other things. And so they look at these barriers, and they see which ones need to be addressed either in this proceeding, the energy storage proceeding that I'll be talking about, or other proceedings that are in place in California. So both, what are the barriers, how should they be addressed, what forum should they be addressed through, and therefore how to proceed. So let me just talk about what some of these barriers are. The first is this issue of the system need. Is there actually a need for storage in the system? Is there some sort of requirement that drives us to have storage? The second one, I'm going to read these because I know you can't see them, there's a lack of a cohesive regulatory framework. You know, there is not a market for some of the products that storage could provide, like this ramping product that we've just talked about. Ramping is a system need, but there's no way to procure it except through what the system operator actually does. So it's very difficult to see how storage could make any money unless the system operator was going to make an offer or a tender to get that kind of ramping product. That also speaks into this, whether there are markets for these products. Resource adequacy accounting refers to, you know, whether you can count the storage against targets we have. I told you about this efficiency, demand response, renewables, loading order. How would storage count into that? There is an absence of a method for determining cost effectiveness. One of the key outcomes of this proceeding was to put information into the record such that a definitive mechanism could be identified and used by the regulators going forward in evaluating the kinds of investments that the utilities are going to make. Next was, how would the utilities get their money back from making these investments in these storage in activities? The other was sort of, what were the prices that would be paid for storage, and that goes hand in hand with the sort of the market question. Finally, there's a lack of commercial operating experience, and how would you get over that as a barrier to having lots more storage on the system? And finally, it was this issue of there's not a real interconnection process. There's interconnection processes for distributed generation, but storage is yet a different animal because of the bidirectional flow that's envisioned. So they went through this process. They had enormous amounts of testimony, and here's what we came out with. So the first thing I bring your attention to is the total. I bring your attention to the amounts that each utility, this is Southern California Edison, this is the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, this is the San Diego Gas and Electric Company. It's going to take place over four staged competitive solicitations, One of the things they debated was how should you get the storage? Should you get it through other means other than associates? Should the utility just go out and buy this stuff and then stick it on there? Instead, they decided that they would go through open solicitation processes that would be held at irregular intervals. They were very concerned about the rate at which the energy storage industry could gear up to meet this kind of new demand for their products. They also divided the applications, the amounts that a company would have to get into transmission, distribution, and customer segments. So again, it was a very deliberative process about thinking about how they would meet this mandate, both over time, by utility service territory, and by the sort of particular application that they would be willing to consider. They also passed a number of rules, again, to sort of tailor this to sort of where is the low-hanging fruit, where are the barriers the greatest, where are the ones that the utility should be trying to address. So, for example, pumped hydro, which is already commercially viable, is essentially ruled out from being participating for installations of over 500 megawatts. They recognized that these solicitations might not work exactly as they were planned and from year to year, so there's an opportunity to defer the procurement from one year to the next, although you don't have an opportunity to reduce the total. You can do some trading between the transmission and distribution requirements for a given utility service territory, but you cannot trade across the utility service territories for how you meet these commitments. And then finally, the utility cannot own more than 50% of these. So again, a lot of very specific rules on how the procurements will be implemented, stemming from sort of the assessment of the barriers in the appropriate world for a public policy in this setting. This is the slide I'm going to conclude with. This is the regulatory process that we just concluded this fall, in which the procurement targets for the first year were articulated for each of the utilities. And so at the top, going across the top, you have the requirements by utility, but then they netted against that applications that were already in progress. In particular, in Southern California, many of you have heard that one of our large nuclear power stations will never come back into service. That's created a significant challenge in what's called the South Coast Air Basin. This is the area that's sort of straddling the area between Los Angeles and San Diego. And so the Public Utilities Commission, independent of this proceeding, ordered Southern California Edison to acquire 1,400 megawatts of new capacity, of which 50 megawatts must be storage. So they're already sort of on the hook for storage here, and they're already in procurement to buy a lot of this storage, and therefore their requirement in the first year has been bought down by that amount. So anyway, these amounts that are to be procured in this first solicitation, the solicitations will be actually issued next month, vary by utility, and have been netted against sort of existing commitments that have been made. So with that, I'm going to conclude, and I'll look forward to the discussion at the end of the session. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Chris Reagan, and I have no slides. And I apologize for getting here late. I missed the first three speakers, I think. So I come from a large family, six boys, and your regular number of mothers and fathers. A lot of engineers in the family. A lot of engineers in my family. I'm not one of them. I know approximately nothing about everything you've been speaking about, which makes me an obvious person to be the final panelist. So I'm an economist, all right? And that makes me quite different from an energy engineer or a mechanical engineer or for anybody, frankly, that understands most of the slides that you've just been looking at for the last 40 minutes. So why am I here? I am here to talk about economic policy, and I'm here to talk about how economic policy might be able to lead to changes in the technologies that we develop and the technologies that we use. And I'm going to talk about that through the lens of fiscal policy and why it matters. So let me just talk a little bit about what economists mean by fiscal policy. Fiscal policy, we all actually feel the effects of fiscal policy. We typically feel the effects of fiscal policy in a negative way when we get to the end of April and we're filling out our tax form. Some of you may fill out your own tax form and feel the pain, not only the pain of writing a check, but the pain of actually having to fill out the tax form. But some of us, most of us, also feel the effects of fiscal policy in regular life when we use and benefit from many things that our various governments provide us. So fiscal policy is all about the way that the governments, plural, federal government, provincial governments, local governments, how they collect revenue and how they spend the revenue on many things, from national defense to local sewers and everything in between. And fiscal policy is partly about just the mundane things, which is let's collect a bunch of money and then let's spend a bunch of money. But fiscal policy is actually not usually designed that crudely. It's actually designed by a bunch of exceedingly clever and creative economists. Almost redundant. What lies at the heart of fiscal policy is knowledge about incentives. And incentives that is created through the tax system, through the expenditure system, what economists would typically call relative prices, and I'll come back to that. So I just want to try to convince you for a moment that the fiscal system is already full of incentives, and trying to change your behavior through incentives, cleverly designed incentives, and some of which you absolutely know about these. So how many people in this audience have an RRSP? So if you don't have an RRSP, first of all, you should open one up. Okay, just this is me being fatherly and providing you with some financial advice. Almost everybody in this room has a financial incentive to create an RRSP. If you haven't done it, you really should do it. But quite apart from just providing you with personal financial advice, the way RRSPs work is that they provide a tax credit for you to save. They provide a financial incentive. The money that you put into an RRSP is treated differently than the money you put in an ordinary bank account. And because of that tax incentive, there is actually a fair amount of evidence that people actually save more. Okay? It changes their behavior. How many of you have a mortgage on a house? Well, in this country, there is no tax incentive to having a mortgage. But if you lived in the United States, your mortgage interest is tax deductible. It's actually very bad policy, but that's a longer story. But in the United States, mortgage tax deductibility changes behavior. It gets people to take out larger mortgages than they otherwise would. And in fact, one of the reasons why it's a problem is that it feeds into or fuels housing bubbles that periodically happen in the United States. In Canada, we don't have that policy. How many people have a TFSA, tax-free savings account? Okay, well, if you don't have one of these, you really should open up one of these too, okay? Because this is another, through the tax system, financial incentive to change your behavior. So for those people who have a TFSA, you probably save more than you otherwise would. Again, changing behavior. We've only had TFSAs in place for about 5 years, so we don't really have enough data to really compellingly determine that, in fact, they have causally increased saving, but they probably have. The tax system is also full of, in this country and other countries, investment tax credits. These are things that most of us as individuals don't encounter, but some people here who own firms or work for firms may benefit from investment tax credits. These are tax incentives for firms to actually spend some money or borrow money to actually expand their facilities or buy new machines. These are tax credits given to investment. Tuition tax credits. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. One of the reasons why it is painful to fill out your taxes in April is not only that you have to write a check at the end of the year, but that there are many, many lines in the tax form. And there are many, many lines, and if you've ever filled out a corporate tax form, it's a ridiculous number of lines because there are a lot of elements of the tax system, and they are all about changing incentives so that you can change behavior. So that's what fiscal policy is about. And it is frustrating to fill out the tax forms and see all of those lines that you have to read and then decide that they don't apply to you, and it takes you a long time to get to the bottom of the page. But the truth is, they are all there for a reason. Not all of them are cleverly designed. Some of them are stupidly designed for crazen, craven political reasons. But many of them are, in fact, sensibly designed and are there for sensible reasons. So let me talk then, connect this all to what we're talking about here, which is how to improve fiscal policy in a way that you might care about. So let me just state, and I think this is agreed upon, that there is a goal among people in this room and elsewhere to reduce society's overall use of fossil fuels. That seems to be something that is an underlying belief, not only to reduce the use of fossil fuels, but to increase the use of non-fossil fuels, and in particular, things that are not emitting of greenhouse gases. So to reduce the use of fossil fuels and to increase the use of non-emitting energy sources. Well, if that's the goal, the question then is how could fiscal policy actually help achieve that outcome? And one thing that can work, does work in other jurisdictions, is a two-part policy, and it's an overall policy that I will call an eco-fiscal policy, which is a policy that is designed to improve environmental outcomes and improve economic outcomes at the same time. Many people think that those two things stand in competition, that you can't have a stronger economy without damaging the environment, or that you can't actually clean up the environment without damaging your economy. This is a belief that many people have. I think it is absolutely false. And I think it is starting to be realized that it is false. And if people want to talk about that later on, we can talk about that. But a relatively simple tax on carbon emissions, something you have all heard about, will generate revenues. Anybody who emits greenhouse gases actually is required to pay a tax on those emissions. That tax could start at $20 a ton. It could ramp up over time to a much higher number. But it will generate revenues, and in fact, it will generate a large amount of revenues. The second part is to actually recycle those revenues back into the economy. And governments have many choices to recycle those revenues. You could reduce corporate income taxes. You could reduce personal income taxes. You could give the money to low-income households who now have to face higher energy prices. You could use the money to finance investment in clean tech. You could use the money to finance critical infrastructure, which in this city seems to be always falling down. And I say that with a great deal of admiration because I love my city. I just don't trust the Turcotte interchange for much longer. So this is an option that other jurisdictions have used. Denmark has used it. BC has used it. Quebec is using it in a slightly different form. They're not using a tax on carbon, but they're using a cap and trade system, which works a little bit differently, but it still imposes a price on the emission of carbon and generates revenue if it's done in an appropriate way. I want to argue that this is a better way to solve the problem, and I want to talk about how it's going to solve the problem. But it's a better way than some of the alternatives. Some governments, most governments actually, love to give out subsidies. They love to give out political pork. They like to give money to wind generators or solar panel producers or other forms of energy producers. They love to effectively pick good projects and then give money to them, and they call it a green policy. One of the problems with subsidies is that we actually don't know, as a general rule, which alternative to fossil fuel is going to be best today, and certainly don't know which alternatives will be best in 10 years' time or 15 years' time. Taxing the thing that you know to be bad, which is the carbon emissions, is actually very different than trying to subsidize the things that you think are good. Not only do you set yourself up for political problems, because as soon as governments announce themselves to be open to the business of giving out money, everybody has a green project. And while governments have a very hard time picking winners, losers have a very easy time picking governments. So you want to worry about how effective subsidies are. The other alternative to this kind of policy is having direct regulations or direct mandates. And one of the problems, so you heard just about renewable renewable energy mandate, so something that says 20% of our cars will be clean by such and such a time, or we will just impose direct prescriptive regulations on specific industries. One of the problems with this is that different firms in different industries, different households for that matter, have different abilities in reducing emissions. They have different needs in their businesses. They have different preferences in their homes. They have different priorities. And direct prescriptive regulations tend to be, while they are effective at reducing a particular type of pollution, or carbon, if we're talking about carbon, they tend to do it not at least cost. Whereas when you impose a tax on a particular type of pollution, and everybody faces the same tax, then you can use the market forces to actually bring people about to reductions in a least cost way. And if people want to talk more about how that occurs, I can talk about that. So I would argue that having a tax on pollution, and in this case a tax on carbon, where you recycle the revenues in a very variety of ways, is actually a better policy than subsidies or direct regulations. My final thing, because I'm probably out of time, is really the nub of the matter, which is, why is this going to actually change technology? Well, if you actually attach a carbon, a price to carbon emissions, so let's call it a carbon tax, you're going to generate technological change in two ways. Number one, right out of the gates, as soon as you put a price onto carbon emissions, you generate an economic incentive to avoid emitting carbon. So whether they're businesses or whether they're households, there's now an economic incentive to avoid whatever that polluting or emitting activity is. And so people find ways to avoid it. This is what firms who are interested in maximizing profits do. It's what households who are interested in actually retaining some income so that they can buy more chocolate ice cream do, okay, or whatever flavor you like. But they look for ways to avoid paying the pollution tax. And they innovate their way around paying that pollution tax. That's good. That innovation is exactly what we want. So firms develop methods that will avoid the pollution. Or they adopt methods that already exist that they weren't using before. Okay, that's the first half of the innovation story. The second half of the innovation story comes from how the government chooses to recycle those revenues. If you generate a bunch of several billion dollars worth, for example, of revenues through taxing carbon, and then you decide to recycle those revenues, you can actually encourage more innovation depending on how you decide to recycle those revenues. You could use those revenues to invest directly into clean tech. Now, I just said subsidies to clean tech aren't such a good idea. So what you have to do is do it in a sensible way. Something like Sustainable Technology Development Canada, SDTC, is a federal crown corporation that actually gives out money to clean tech in a politically arm's-length way on a merit-based system. And systems like that actually are quite effective. So there's the double effect on technological change. One is the innovation away from the tax on pollution. And the second is how you actually spend the revenues. I want to leave you with a question. Some people say this sounds great, but it's not enough. And other people will say, well, no, this is enough. If you actually introduced a carbon tax, and it could start at $20 a ton, and it could ramp up over 20 years to $150 a ton, some people will say, and this is a debate within the economics profession, some economists will say, this will create the price signals you need. This will create the incentives for the innovation that you need. Just get the prices right, put the tax in place, ramp it up over time, and watch the technology unfold. Right? All of those smart engineers are now not only going to be doing things because they're cool and they like to figure this stuff out, but their boss is going to say, we need a way to avoid this carbon tax, so work a little harder, come up with something. And there's a bunch of technological change that happens because there's a lunatic working in his basement. And there's a lot of technological change that happens because people are trying to solve an economic problem. And so this one half of the economics group says, you get the tax in place, you get the prices right, the incentives will be fundamentally altered, just watch the technology unfold. The other half says, you know, the tax on carbon is a really good idea. It's probably even necessary, but it's probably not sufficient. So this side says you will get a bunch of technological change with a carbon tax, especially over time. But in order to get the global level of reductions, emission reductions we need by the time we think we need it, we simply can't generate the alternative power sources fast enough. So what we really need is to take some of that revenue from the carbon tax and sponsor, government-sponsored, technological race, kind of like the moon race, the space race we had back in the 60s. This would be the green technology race. So this is quite a legitimate debate. Some people saying that a tax is necessary and sufficient. The other half saying it is necessary but not sufficient. But I don't actually know any economist who thinks that a carbon tax, sensibly done, is not a crucial part of a policy package going forward. Let me end with BC. BC introduced a carbon tax in 2008. So they've got about 8 different fuel types they applied this tax to in a perfectly sensible way. And they legislated right from the outset that the revenues raised from the carbon tax would be spent, if you like, would be matched by tax reductions elsewhere. So any dollar raised through the carbon levy would be associated also with equal reductions in personal and corporate income taxes. It's written into the law, and in fact, what they've done over 5 years is that they have lowered personal and corporate income taxes by more dollars than raised the carbon levy. Per capita fuel use fell in that province over the past 5 years by 16%. Per capita fuel use, 16%. In the rest of the country, went up by 3%. GDP in BC tracked GDP in the rest of the country. So they had no measurable or no observable economic hit. They appear to have had a successful reduction in fuel use. Fuel use, as you know far better than I, is connected basically one-to-one with emissions. It is politically stable. And now, because of the way it's written into legislation, any reduction in the carbon tax must be offset by an increase in some other tax. Nobody wants to do that. So this is a very politically stable, satisfactory outcome. This can be a political winner, and it is certainly an economic winner, and it does generate technological change, specifically over time. So let me stop there, and I hope there are lots of good questions. Thank you.
So thank you very much to all our speakers. Now we will start the question and answer period from the audience. There are microphones located on both aisles here. So if you have any specific questions for our panel, please feel free to come up to the microphone. I'll have to start the panel, perhaps start with Professor Kirshen. Do you have any reactions to what you've heard so far tonight?
I want to ask a question to Christopher. You talked about carbon taxes. Could you compare carbon taxes with cap and trade, which is the other mechanism that has been proposed for reducing emissions?
Yes. I could compare them. Would you like me to?
I have no doubt that you could.
So I'll be brief. A carbon tax and a cap and trade system are alternative ways of attaching a price to carbon emissions. And in principle, in a textbook world, they're actually pretty close to equivalent, or at least under some conditions. Okay, two differences. Number one, let me just assume that enforcement design is sensible and enforcement is appropriate. A carbon tax will guarantee the price that everybody pays for emissions. If you have a path of a carbon tax moving forward, then the price you pay for emissions is determined by that path. If you have a cap and trade system, what you're setting is not the price, but you're setting the quantity, the amount of pollution, the amount of carbon emissions permitted in any given year. And the price that firms end up paying for the tradable permits ends up being determined in a free market. And so in the cap and trade system, what we're certain about is the amount that pollution will fall. Under the carbon tax system, what we're certain about is the price that everybody will pay. Okay? So they're kind of opposite. We're certain about different things. That's one important difference. The second difference is that a tax is administratively far simpler. In a cap and trade system, because we create these things that are tradable pollution permits that are effectively securities, has to get into securities regulation and lawyers that go with securities regulation and corruption that goes with lawyers and securities regulation. And so administratively, I think cap and trade systems are just more complicated.
No more credit.
Sir, please.
Yeah. I have two questions for Mr. Edo from the Golden State. My first question is the energy storage mandate by the state of California. You mentioned calls for 1.3 gigawatt of energy storage by the year 2020. Normally we use megawatt for power capacity, and energy storage we typically talk in terms of megawatt hours or gigawatt hours. So my question is, why do they use the unit gigawatt for their target for energy storage?
I don't have a good answer for you, but I can tell you that they considered, in looking at the different use cases, what the amount of watt hours that would need to be associated with the watts of capacity for those different applications. But again, I think the legislation was written in terms of, and the way it was framed was written in terms of an installed capacity target.
Okay. My second question was the chart you showed with regards to targets for transmission, distribution, and customers. The public transit agencies that operate rail transportation networks in California, such as BART in San Francisco or LA Metro as an example, would they fall into the customers category for the
targets? That would be my understanding, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
And I have a question now for Professor Bernier regarding the potential. Please. The audience first. We've talked enough.
All right. Very interesting conversations and very interesting presentations as well. I'm going to ask you something that is related but a bit different. I spent quite a bit of time talking to various policymakers from Canada and England about the potential economic repercussions, but also physical repercussions on the system itself of a potential CME. Now, coronal mass ejections are rare events. However, they have roughly a 100-year cycle, and we're about at the peak of the next event, according to various individuals. Now, estimates range between, if one were to hit North America or Europe, you could have blackouts that would last between a few weeks to a few months. Now, what I'm curious about is if we were to improve some of these energy storage facilities or capabilities, could we somehow mitigate some of those negative impacts on the grid itself?
Daniel, from a perspective, I think it depends on where the storage is located. My understanding is that the vulnerability of the power system has to do with the damage to transformers that would be initiated by the electromagnetism. And so if the storage is located downstream of the transformers, and again, this speaks to Professor Yost's discussion about microgrids, then you would have a more distributed form of supply that would be more resilient to attack on or threats to the bulk power distribution system, because I think the biggest concern is irreparable damage to very large transformers. The other professors, I'm sure, have other perspectives too.
Well, if you had a highly distributed power system where a lot of the energy is generated very locally,
and you had local storage, yes, then it would improve the resilience. If we're not there, meaning, you know, there's a bit of storage in your garage and mine, well, you might have another 2-3 hours of electricity, but then you'd still be in the dark for a few months. So I don't see it as the best way of improving resilience of the grid to those events.
Thank you. What it brings up is also the conversation we've had in the past. What if, you know, in Europe now, in fast forward 20, 30 years from now, what if there is a low-pressure system that just stalls over Europe and nothing, no wind blows for, I don't know, 2 weeks? What happens? That's another question. Do we have enough storage to deal with that? Sir.
My questions possibly will apply mostly to Canada, and many of our experts come from elsewhere. There are two unspoken assumptions that I am not hearing spoken about, and maybe because I'd worked in BC, where wilderness is everywhere, they arise to my head. And I also listen to Vermont News, and they're a tiny little market with giant grids crossing them. Implicit in a lot of your storage technologies is that they are direct current sources of power. And so you either have to do relatively inefficient conversions from AC to DC and then from DC storage to AC again and try to synchronize frequencies and make sure all of those stability questions of the AC grid are sustained, or you're going to have to slowly but steadily convert the North American grid to a DC grid. And that's particularly important on the local distribution questions I heard addressed. I can't imagine converting those little micro and nano grids to be synchronous with the AC system. Have you exactly looked at how much capital is involved in converting the entire grid from AC and substations and power generation and controls to DC? And the second one I want to just throw in is, especially when we're talking distributed power like these wind sources, which are dominant in Quebec, in BC they inevitably generate vast human intrusions into vast territories which are now wilderness. Essentially, we're not internalizing the costs of converting wilderness to settled, civilized land. And in BC, that's costly. It has tremendous effects on water courses. It has tremendous effects on wildlife populations. All the services that the environment gives us are affected when we turn lots of little transmission lines and pathways into power stations and control units all over the place. Why aren't we internalizing wilderness when we're talking about this? So the two questions are capitalizing the change from AC to DC, and how much external values have we taken into account? I hope this is not too abstract. They jump to my mind whenever we talk like this.
Okay, so you want to jump in about the DC?
No.
This is a can of worms.
No, it's the cost.
It's the cost.
Yeah, the DC technologies, in my perspective, have values at the two extremes of the grid. One, DC is more efficient and more stable when you're talking about transmitting large amounts of power over long distances. And we're already doing quite a bit of that, and that amount is growing. At the other end, within your house, it does make sense to have a bit of a DC grid because you are using a lot of things. You know, your computers are running on DC, your television is running on DC. And so if we could have just one DC converter rather than going back and forth between AC and DC, that could save a lot of money. In between, I'm not convinced that DC makes sense. I don't have any numbers to back that up, but that's my feeling at this point.
And I guess in terms of the land use, Joe, if you want to perhaps comment. Well, again, it's one of those externalities that need to be quantified in some way or another in the planning process.
I also want to comment on the DC.
Okay.
Thing. DC is making inroads in places where it makes economic sense right now, and those are like data centers, you know, where they can drive the large racks without having to convert the electricity. But to your earlier comment, the inverters are quite efficient, and they're also quite controllable. So I don't think that's a barrier to more DC power. But the main observation that Jay's sort of said under his breath is, you know, the AC system is working. And so, you know, this is a system that changes very slowly. So, you know, you see niche applications of DC like these data centers. You see niche high voltage applications where there's power that's very distant from its point of use, and it makes sense to just build a pipe straight from one point to the other. But in between, you know, we have a large AC network, and you know, much as we want to modernize the grid, the basic infrastructure that is here standing today will still be standing here 10 years from now and 20 years from now, and we need to figure out how to operate it better, not think that we're going to replace it wholesale. To the other question, and perhaps Professor Ragan will also comment, is that, you know, the world, there's not a free lunch out here. You know, the whole point of a carbon tax is to try to internalize the cost that's associated with the damage that we believe carbon is causing to our planet and to make it evident in the decisions that people make. But that said, the decisions that we make, they're all having costs. And, you know, I think there's been a big challenge to the wind farm development because it takes up an enormous amount of land. And that's just a fact. Jeff showed a picture of those farms in Germany. I've been in parts of the Pacific Northwest where it's just a blanket of these things. And, you know, if you like technology, it's great. But, you know, if you were used to seeing open fields, you know, it's quite a difference. And I guess the question is, well, how do we as a society want to make the trade-off between the choices we have for how we use energy and how we produce energy? And that's really what these discussions are about, I say, at bottom.
I couldn't add anything to that. That was perfect, everything he said.
Sir.
Yeah, that the last question, it kind of reminds me, it doesn't remind me when I was alive, Tesla talking to Edison saying, hey, Tesla's in Europe, he wants AC, he's got AC, and the United States wanted DC. And, you know, Edison supposedly paid Tesla $50,000 to get the technology. He still hasn't paid him. Maybe that's why the discussion is going 150 years later. That's just a moot point. That's my view. I'm a civil engineer. Okay, now look, I thought we solved this problem 50 years ago. I mean, I worked on the nuclear power plant in Rajasthan, India, in 1960. It was the first nuclear power plant in India. And I remember it cost, I'm talking about costs now. It cost $1 million a megawatt. And it was very simple, a lot of concrete, and you know, all the nuclear technology was CANDU. And CANDU's still around, a little modified now, but still. And I went to the conference board. I was invited there to have a discussion on nuclear. Now, I know you're not talking about nuclear, but I just want to get you a cost a story out there that is probably similar to what you guys are talking about. And all of a sudden, we come to the conference board. That was a couple of years ago, 50 years later. And they're saying, now it's going to cost $6 million a megawatt. And I says, is that the price of concrete that's gone up or what? I mean, you know, there's a problem with costing these things. And there's no competition to identify any new technology. The sky's the limit. And the politicians are obviously going to say, hey, we can't afford this. And that's, I'm sure they're saying that with a carbon tax and whatever you want. So I'd like to know what controls, what regulation do we require to identify that, hey, there's the sky's not the limit. Maybe the technology and the, you know, is a limit, but is, you know, we can great think we're great engineers, eh? We're not paid like doctors and lawyers, that's for sure. And by the way, this whole problem is waiting for the lawyers to line themselves up. This is a global thing. The lawyers got to be all lined up globally, and they'll say, well, now we can each make a buck. And I heard this story 10, 15 years ago, and they're still lining themselves up.
Sir,
question is, well,
yes,
how do you control the costs?
So the question was, how much could storage cost? So I don't know.
That one's yours.
Christopher.
I have a simple and fully unsatisfactory answer to how do you control costs on government procurement, which is competition. It's the only thing that I think
ever works, ever has, probably ever will. So if you don't have, which means, we in this country, it means governments should be able to get proposals from outside the province. And it means the federal government needs proposals from outside the country. This actually runs rather in opposition to most human nature, which is very protectionist. So if we really want to lower the costs of building, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a nuclear plant or a hospital or a road, it doesn't have to be high tech to have this problem, is we need genuine competition in the procurement process. Don't hold your breath. Because that means you need politicians and, you know, you need to force politicians to open up to competition. And that means you have to really believe it, and 30 million other people have to really believe it.
When we were negotiating a contract with India, I remember it well. We weren't talking to India. India wasn't talking to us. That was 1960. And we had an intermediary who, I won't we had to have an agent to put the deal together, and the project cost $200 million for 15%. Hey, that was part of the cost, because we don't even talk to each other. In that case, it was $15 million to some stranger in the Middle East.
Okay. And, sir?
Yeah, my question is for Jeff Gostick.
What is that, a humorous anecdote?
Oh, sorry.
Oh. The reason why pumped hydro was developed in my country was a direct offspring of the nuclear power plant development program, because these units, to be economic, had to be of such a large size that the utilities didn't know what they were going to do with the power at night when people went to sleep. And so that was the whole reason why our pumped storage industry was developed. Funny. Just to bring it back to another reason why storage, you know, has these important values.
Well, it's just like the lights on the highways in France. There's so much lighting in the...
And I can add another one about the cost of storage. You know, there's something called community energy storage, where you can go and buy batteries that might, you know, help a few houses and things like that. Well, it turns out that that's about the same size batteries as you get in a small electric car. Now, if you ask a quote for community energy storage batteries, well, that's about the cost of an electric car. So you're getting the car for free with the batteries, and you can choose the color of the car, obviously. So it shows that there is still quite a bit of an inefficiency in the cost of battery energy storage for grid applications compared to what car manufacturers have been able to do.
Sir, please.
So actually my question is with regards to battery efficiency. You spoke of flow batteries. It was somewhat the first time that I hear about this. One of the ratings that we use in battery technology is the C rating. And, you know, the higher that the C rating is, the better the battery can deliver energy and recoup that energy or recharge itself. Recently, I've been reading that lithium titanate can reach a level of C15. In your vision, these flow batteries, what kind of C rating can we reach if that seems to be the next big thing in battery technology?
Well, I mean, C rating is sort of, you know, got a bunch of things included. I think to break it down more simply, the faster you discharge the battery, the less efficient it is, because you bring in heat generation and all kinds of side reactions and so on. So if you charge and discharge your thing very, very slowly, you have very high efficiency. So that's the what you're looking for in an electrical storage system. So that the battery will be designed that way to operate it fairly. You have a large battery with low current density instead of a small battery with very high current density. So because you have the luxury of having lots of space and presumably at your generation and storage site, you can operate your battery efficiently.
So what footprint can this type of battery take in with regards to the same capacity as a lithium battery, for example?
The power generation device, the cell itself can be made small if you engineer it to, you know, have lots of surface area and so on, so that it has, you know, good power performance characteristics. You're limited really by the size of the tanks storing the fuel. So, and the fuel is a dissolved electrolyte, which has a solubility limit. You know, you put too much salt in your water, and it's, you know, you no longer get dissolving, you get crystals. So the you know, you can play games with increasing the solubility of your fuels, choosing different fuels that have different solubilities. So you get to be quite variable the size of the tank that you'll need, and you know, those are all things that people are aiming for to improve. But as far as actual footprints, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess right now off the top of my head, sorry.
Give you an idea, a 1 megawatt, 1 megawatt battery is about the size of a large shipping container, and typically they are sold as a shipping container containing everything.
For
both about the same size, lithium ion and flow batteries.
Okay, we'll take one last question before we wrap it up.
Well, three last questions, please. but they're quick. I mean, it depends on you. First of all, about the flow battery, are these chemicals repletable? I mean, is this a two-way process like lithium batteries?
Absolutely, yeah. They're extremely durable in the sense that there's no phase change going on. You don't have something dissolving and replating. You don't have lithium moving in and out of a structure. You have a liquid dissolved ion. It just comes in contact with a solid and changes its oxidation state and then goes away. So in that respect, they're extremely appealing.
And that's true with the full list you've shown?
I actually avoid, there are some. I know the soluble lead battery I threw on there because I wanted to point out lead. It has a phase change going on, and there's a zinc polysulfide battery that has a phase change where you're plating out metal and unplating the metal. Not in a fancy structure like a lead battery, a zinc battery. You're just plating it as a thick solid layer, so you don't have to worry about structure and things. But there are some technologies that are a little more complicated. But all the ones I showed were simply liquid phase reactions, I believe. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Second question is: you have shown many means of storage, but are these only the most viable, the most feasible, or are they all we can do?
Was that for me or for everybody?
That was for everybody.
Okay. Well, viable, of course, is the first thing you have to think about as an engineer. So the ones I showed tonight are viable. You can imagine other things, I suppose.
On large scale, you mean, right?
Sure. Yeah.
One technology that was not discussed explicitly tonight was mechanical storage in the form of flywheels, of which there are a number of companies trying to develop that for very short duration, high power applications.
Okay. Thank you. And my last question was about the graph I believe Mr. Bernier showed on the ground storage, the ground heat storage. It showed some irregularities by the end on the two last cycles. Is this something you've noticed? Is this something that is a tendency that will continue and snowball?
I think you're referring to the last two cycles where the curve showed dips and valleys and whatnot. I believe that is due to the fact that there was some variability with the solar injection and or the space heating needs, great variations, okay? So when you have that, this curve goes up and down quite frequently.
Okay, but the ground and ecosystem can deal with this?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So it's about time, I think, we start to wrap up. So thank you very much to the audience for coming. Thank you for staying with us. Thank you to our speakers, especially Joe Etto and Daniel Kirshen, who made it from far away to attend this event. I'd also like to thank the TISED staff, Lauren Penny, Robin Devine, Professor Gauchal, the director of TISED, for support for this event. This wouldn't have happened without them. And also, finally, Dr. Lauren Trottier and his generous support to the Trottier Family Foundation. So thank you for coming. We hope you've learned something. Hopefully that you think that perhaps storage is part of the solution and that perhaps carbon taxes might be also part of the solution. And we hope to see you at the TISED event or sustainability event later. Thank you very much.